Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting. I'll be your moderator for today's program, How to Make Sense of the Disorder in the Middle East. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Dr. Yoaz Hendel. Dr. Hendel describes himself as a pragmatic centrist with a national liberal identity. He's involved with a number of socially responsible organizations and has received numerous awards for his work. He received his PhD in military history from Tel Aviv University and was a postdoctorate fellow at the Begin-Sadat Center for Strategic Studies. He's also a combat veteran who served in an elite Israeli commando unit. From 2011 to 2012, he served as Prime Minister Netanyahu's communications director. Dr. Hendel is an award-winning author, media analyst, and senior columnist covering politics, security, social issues, and civil society. As chair of the Institute of Zionist Studies, Dr. Hendel established a human rights organization to help individuals support Palestinian rights and dignity and to help Israel as a just and worthy society. Following the program, he'll be signing his book, Israel vs. Iran, A Shadow War. Would you please welcome Dr. Yoaz Hendel.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'm after a long flight from Israel, and on my way, I saw so many Israelis coming here for a high-tech conference, and maybe the right thing to start with is to remind everyone that before that Israel has become a startup nation, we were actually the orange nation. And I'm telling you, probably you are familiar with the Jaffa orange that we export in the past, but I'm telling you that because behind every conflict, a national and religious conflict, there are interests. And part of the interests are economically, part of the interests are politically. And one should understand the conflict in the Middle East and the disability in the Middle East, not only through the self-religious, national feelings, but also by other dimensions of the Middle East. In 2012, I participated in the peace talks in Amman. I was a part of a small delegation that sat with the Palestinians in Amman, in the intelligence corps house in the center of Jordan. And for me, it was an interesting experience. First of all, we had the great food, nice hummus, good baklawas. I'm not sure that you're familiar with baklawas. If not, you might find it somewhere. It's very nice, very sweetie. Good coffee, but not that good peace. And my conclusion from those meetings, and we had 1 month of meetings twice in a week, I think, my conclusions were, first of all, that it's almost impossible to bridge the gaps, and I will speak about it in a moment, between both sides. Not because both sides have very strong and tough demands, but they are cultural and other gaps that it's very hard to bridge. Secondly, Another conclusion was that even if you are not a sailor, you can suffer from a sea disease when you are taking the roads with the Jordanian intelligence. And for me, the most important conclusion was the gaps between the declarations, the formal declarations of different actors in the Middle East and the reality. When we sat there together, Palestinians, Israelis, the Quartet, which was actually responsible for organizing the meetings, the Jordanian foreign minister, We all spoke about some kind of a deal that not exist. Every meeting after every day that we every time whenever we finished the meeting without any real outcomes, we found ourselves with the Jordanian foreign minister talking about different narratives. And one of the things that I understood that there is a huge gap between the Jordanian interest and what they are talking about formally. There are a huge difference between the Palestinian interests and what they can speak loudly. And there are also a huge gap between what we are saying loudly and what we are doing on the ground. And I think it's a good point to start with, the gap. This gap that the common people do not understand, and it's very hard even to people that live in the Middle East, Israelis and others, to understand it completely. The Palestinians are only one subject in the Middle East. Today we live in a destable area. What we knew in the past, the armies that were part of the threats from Israeli point of view, today are almost not exist. The Egyptians are focusing on other issues and Israel and in the north. Syria, as you know, now in internal war, more than 500,000 people were slaughtered by Muslims in Syria and other parts of this area. Lebanon, specifically the Hezbollah, which is one of the threats that we knew in the past, specifically in the second Lebanon war in 2006, today are a part of the war in Syria, and they have no sources and the abilities to create another war against Israel. And the Middle East has changed, and it has changed in two main manners. One of them is the fact that it seems that it's very hard to gamble or to take any risks when you don't know what will happen tomorrow morning with those countries, including Jordan that I just mentioned. The second dimension of that is that when you look at the Middle East, you understand that the real conflict is between the moderates, Muslims in the Middle East, and the extreme, and I would say voices, because it's not always that clear to understand them, the extreme voices that we hear in different countries, including ISIS and other actors that we see in the neighborhoods. Another point that we need to understand that is Iran. And the book that you just mentioned, I wrote before I joined the Prime Minister office. And you know that in Israel, to be a journalist, it's a very complicated situation. I think it's much more complicated, and Robert, maybe you can say about it a few words later, but I think it's much more complicated than in any other country. You can write a column one day to recommend your government to go to a war or to eliminate Hamas or to do that or that, and the day after you can find yourself in the middle of a war with a call from the reserve duty service, and you actually have a kind of responsibility for your own words. Depends on your influence, but if we understand that the media influence politicians, so you are in a kind of a game that is not really clear to other people in the world. In one hand, you write about recommendations about regarding peace and war. In other hand, you have brothers, kids, and whatever that actually participate or serve or are in the middle of a service in the IDF. And it's becoming much more complicated. So before I joined the Prime Minister's office, I gave you this short briefing because before I joined the Prime Minister's office, I wrote this book with a very strong recommendation to launch a military strike against Iran. And for me, as advisor from outside that writing about whatever he wants, it was very easy. And then one day I found myself as director of communications and public diplomacy at the Prime Minister's office, and suddenly some professional journal from the States asked me to publish one of the chapters, and I agree, of course. I was an academician in those days before I joined the Prime Minister's office, and suddenly it became a big story. How one of Netanyahu advisors recommend actually to launch a military strike. And suddenly I understood that those words has also a kind of responsibility. And in Hebrew, we have this sentence that actually Prime Minister Ariel Sharon used to say whenever they ask him how he changed his mind, he said that there are sins that you see from here and you don't see them for there. And they suddenly understood that there is a kind of responsibility for my words. So I'm not changing my mind about the hegemony of Iran in our neighborhood. I haven't changed my mind regarding the fact that Iran with a nuclear weapon can change the environment and can banned investments from overseas towards Israel. I'm not changing my mind regarding the fact that Iran with a nuclear weapon is mainly a threat for the moderate countries, Arabic moderate countries. But I know that today we are in a much complicated situation, and we will speak probably in a moment about the meeting between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump in the next few days. But one of the things that we do understand from President Obama period is that the contract between, or the deal that Israel fought against it for many months, the deal between Iran and the international community, actually moved the military option from the table. And from that point, we see the Russians and the Chinese with a lot of investments in Iran. And now, if one wants to launch any kind of military attack, he probably will find himself fronting two very important actors in the international community. And I'm not sure that he will be able at all to promote or to put it as a theoretical option on the table. And another point that we need to take under consideration when we are talking about the instability in the Middle East, there are three regime powers in the Middle East. One of them is us, the Israelis, and for that reason I feel uncomfortable from time to time when the state of Israel describes itself as a small shtetl, as we said, as a small community that lived in Poland and afraid from actors in around, and there are voices in Israel that perceive themselves as a small country under threat, under elementary threat from over the world. And I think that Israel is one of the strongest powers in the Middle East. Another strong power is Turkey, and you all familiar with what happened in Turkey in the last half a year. And another one, it's Iran. And those, and I will not speak about it, I will not elaborate about it, but those three actors have a kind of a power balance, and they will remain as the reason for stability and destability in the future. We are now actually can celebrate 50 years of changes in, it's not a real celebration, but it's a kind of 50 years of changes, and I'm not talking about 67 war, 50 years of changes in the atmosphere, or changes in the way that the world deal with wars. Specifically, in the last 50 years, even a bit more than that, you can see that most of the wars or most of the conflicts that we see all over the world, not only in the Middle East, are small wars. which mean asymmetrical wars between strong actors and small actors. And part of it, the best example is Israel. If in 73 we had a huge war between Israel and other actors in the area, since 73 Israel is facing small organizations. Part of them are terror organizations, part of them guerrilla organizations, and it's much more complicated than to fight, than to find a battlefield, to find one specific site, and to understand at the end of the day who defeat who, by conquering, by raising a white flag, or by other means. It's much more complicated because the game rules actually have changed. And this is part of the challenges that we see today regarding Israel and regarding other actors. By the way, you had your own experience in Vietnam, and it was very complicated to fight against the Viet Cong, and the Russians had their own experience in Afghanistan. And the Israelis, unfortunately, find themselves time after time dealing with small guerrilla or terror organizations without any, I would say, logical rules that we can use or understand. Part of the dilemmas or part of the challenges is the fact that we are not talking about wars that at the end of the day one can declare himself as a winner. We are talking about winning images. And those terror organizations, if we take, for example, Hamas in Gaza, which unfortunately we have every 2-3 years, we are launching a military campaign in Gaza Strip, since we don't have many other options. Part of the challenge is to find ways to actually to create the final line, to find way to convince the other side to stop fighting, to find ways to convince the other side to even not to start with a military campaign, to find ways to convince the world that it's much more complicated to cope with terror organization than to fight in a normal or traditional wars as we knew in the past. Another thing that we can understand and we can notice in the Middle East that if in the past we spoke about sophisticated weapons, if we spoke about nuclear weapons and about the futural prophets, today we are actually, instead of advancing the wars, if you call it advancement, we are actually see how the history repeat on itself, how the wars that we see today in the Middle East are actually going back, part of them to the Middle Age, part of them even to the Bar Kokhba revolts in the second century AD, when the Hamas used tunnels and dig actually tunnels against a moderate army, when Daesh, ISIS, used knives in order to cut heads of people, in order to determine people like Genghis Khan, and when actually a sophisticated weapon, missiles, and other capabilities that moderate armies use are not really efficient when you are dealing with those organizations. And it's a problem not only of the Israelis and the Jordanians and the Syrians and the other actors in the area. It's a problem that I think that most of the moderate armies are coping with. Another subject, and I will summarize this short briefing with that, and because I would like to focus on Israel. Another subject or another outcome from those kind of wars or from the situation in the Middle East is the fact that if in the past wars were about who achieve much more territory, who can destroy much more in a better way the enemy, today we are talking about the images and legitimation of the armies that participate in wars. And Israel, I will take another example. The war in Vietnam, the American war in Vietnam, stopped because, not because limit of weapons or limit of power or limit even of a spirit. The only reason that the U.S. stopped the war in Vietnam was the lack of legitimation. The only reason that Israel stopped wars today is because we find ourselves in a kind of a balance between our own need to secure ourselves, to fight against, it doesn't matter which kind of organization, and the fact that there is today we are in an open society, the media is free, and we need to balance between the need for security and the need to keep our own liberal and democratic values, even those that we are under war. What does it mean? It means that the enemy, usually, those terror and guerrilla organizations, understand the limitations of those actors, not only Israel, but others, and they understand that they can use our abilities or our limitations as democratic and liberal country in the middle of a war, and they understand that the fight, it's not about who killed more terrorists or who used to more sophisticated weapon. It's about if you can convince the people that, or if you can convince the international community about your narrative. And it's about war of narratives and not about war of, it's not about using weapons. Now, after I said all that, I think that the most interesting story before Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump are going to meet, the most interesting story today is how Israel, as democratic and liberal country, giving answers about regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, coping with criticism from different actors in the world, and trying to advance itself in order to achieve and to keep and to maintain its own character in a very destable area with one deep understanding that every step that you take, every move that you do, every idea that you have, at the end of the day, you can find yourself in worse situation. And the risk management inside, in the Middle East, and specifically in Israel, it's the main policies that we see today, not only in Israel, but all over this area. And I think that part of the challenges of Israel today is to find way to the to Trump administration to convince him to focus or to understand deeply the situation in Israel, and to even those that in his campaign he announced different announcements, campaign. Now it's the real job, and the real challenge is to convince the Trump administration about how important it to understand the risk management in the Middle East. I think it will help also other actors in the Middle East. I will stop here, and we will talk probably about our character and challenges in the next few minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Yoaz Hendel, for your comments. Now it's time for the question and answer period, and there's certainly a lot of questions. So we might as well get right to what's most current. As communications director for Prime Minister Netanyahu, you obviously knew him very well.
Yeah.
You left the government almost 5 years ago, and we might talk about that a little later. But I think, you know, President Trump obviously doesn't have a long career in elected politics. He's not someone who's known to have really been extraordinarily knowledgeable about international affairs.
Do you think his understanding, or maybe the lack of understanding of the Middle East, is an asset or a negative when he meets with Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Look, I think since I'm not official anymore, so I can speak quite freely. I think that Netanyahu, as Prime Minister, probably hoped that Hillary Clinton will be president. Why? Because you can predict what Hillary Clinton will do if she is a president. Trump as president, it's a huge mystery, not only for you, I'm talking as Israeli, but specifically for us. I can see a scenario that President Trump is waking up one morning and calling Netanyahu and telling him, look, I want to make Israel great again, let's cut a deal. Give them the Tel Aviv, we will do that. So I can see, it sounds funny, but I can see a scenario that Trump decides that he wants a Nobel Prize and actually force us to make some kind of agreement that we cannot achieve. I would say that most of the Israelis are in a very pragmatic period. We understand our limitations. The left in Israel understand the limitations regarding utopic peace agreement. There is no utopic peace agreement. I just described my negotiation period in Amman. The right in Israel understand that there is a Palestinian people and we need to give good answers regarding what we want to do with the Palestinian issue. Between that and that, there are a few pragmatic, I would say, offers, and there is no good, very good answer, as we thought 20 years ago. I think that President Trump can miss this complicated situation by talking about great things, as he used this term, and great deals, instead of talking about small steps. I know that many people in Israel support him, and I also see President Trump as an opportunity for Israel. Why? Because for the first time we can speak about thinking out of the box, about the fact that the two-state solution is not exist anymore, because if you want to really to speak about reality, we can start with three-state solutions. There is a state, militarized state in Gaza, which is an enemy state from our point of view. There is a small state minus, as Prime Minister Netanyahu called it, in Ramallah and the Palestinian Authority, and there is Israel. So the ideas that we knew 20 years ago are not exist anymore, and I think that we might have an opportunity to explain it and a little bit to change it. No one thinks that President Trump is going to be the leader of the settlers in Judea and Samaria, so we need to give also answers, good answers. I'm not sure how long this opportunity is going to continue to survive, and this is a big mystery for us and probably for you also.
Well, two of the most topical subjects that have come up relating to the meeting in 2 days is the embassy going to Jerusalem, which at one point President Trump said it's going to happen, and now he's backing off, and obviously his comments on the settlements, the extension of the settlement policy, and how it might not be a good idea for peace. What do you, as an Israeli and someone who's deeply involved in what's going on, what do you think, and what is the reality of the reaction if the American embassy is moved to Israel, Jerusalem?
The only thing that I know about the Middle East is that no one knows anything. we thought that I think that President Bush was the one that that encouraged the Palestinians to make elections in Gaza, and then we saw how Hamas gained control on Gaza instead of Fatah. We thought that Egypt, the regime of Mubarak, is very healthy and strong, and we saw all the revolution since then. So no one can predict. I can say as Israeli, and I'm not talking only as someone that belonged to one political camp. Jerusalem, it's a kind of consensus in Israel, and if you have a capital, it's quite clear that you would like to see the embassies of different countries in your capital. The fact that those embassies are not there, it's a kind of symbolic, shameful point of view for us. And I think that our goal or our ambitions is to encourage President Trump to move the embassy to Jerusalem. If the Palestinians are going to react or not, I don't know. But I know that whenever we had intifadas, whenever we had a wave of terrorism in the past, there were good excuses. It doesn't matter which kind of excuse, but if they want to initiate another violent circle, they don't need to find new excuses. They can decide on that, and I don't think that we are heading there. I think it's an interest to normalize the situation in Israel, and part of normalization is to understand where are the conflict or where are the debatable areas and where what is not debatable, and specifically West Jerusalem. You can even take off East Jerusalem because there are people that think that East Jerusalem is not part of Israel. I think that specifically West Jerusalem is not a debatable area, and we should see the embassies over there, specifically the embassy of the U.S.
So it sounds like you think there is an option that would happen, and it might actually lead to something positive in terms of a negotiation.
I think it's a very easy step to take for President Trump instead of other steps that the right wing in Israel demanding or thinking that he will take. It's the most easiest step to take from his point of view.
You mentioned something I found very interesting. You mentioned the three sort of power centers being Iran, Turkey, and Israel. And so the question I have is, where does Saudi Arabia fit into that?
It's
or not?
They are, but you can see how Saudi Arabia, it's one of the actors in the area with the good connections in Washington. But still, when you see the actors that are trying to influence the area, you see Turkey, specifically in the past, Iran with the ambitions to become an hegemony, and Israel is that actually isolate formally, but under the scene, has very strong connections with Saudi Arabia and other countries, Jordan, Egypt, and others, with moderate countries, with a common interest, specifically since Iran has become a regime power.
Yeah, just a personal question of your own thinking on, I'm jumping around here, but Assad. I mean, Israel has been in a state of war with Syria since its birth. And yet, under the Assad regime since 1973, the 73 Yom Kippur War, and you can talk about what happened in Lebanon with the Syrians being there, but there really has not been direct conflict between Israel and Syria. Is it better for Israel in a way if Assad survives?
Look, I think that we see in Israel a huge debate today. There is this famous words that we're saying in the Holocaust Day, never again. It's not about interest and not about strategic point of view. It's about how Jews can live in Israel when they have in the northern border people that slaughtered day by day, and we are talking about more than 500,000 people. And we just heard about some report about some kind of a refugees camp in Syria, and there is a huge question how we can be, I would say, how we can sit quietly when we see what's happening in our backyard. And in the past, Begin said about Iran-Iraq war that he wished luck for both sides. Today, it's very hard to say that. After you see the numbers, after you see the suffer from Syria, it's very hard to talk about wishing luck to both sides. And I think that the dilemma, it's a moral dilemma. It's not about who going to survive. Both sides are not good for Israel. ISIS are not really Zionistic supporters. Assad is not really enthusiastic regarding the Zionistic ideas. Both sides are not really happy with the existence of Israel. We prefer stabilities and a dysfunctional state, but we don't really know who is going to create stronger stability. And the fact that Iran involved in all, above all of that, it's also a huge challenge for us.
So right now, you mentioned earlier that one thing you can't predict is make a prediction in the Middle East. So right now, with ISIS, you have the Saudis, Sunnis. You have all these conversations going on in different alignments. You have the Saudis in Yemen. You have the Iranians in Yemen. You have the Iranians against ISIS using Hezbollah and their own Revolutionary Guard in Syria. You have the Iraqis fighting ISIS. You have the Americans fighting ISIS. You have the Russians fighting ISIS. Are we confused yet? But these alliances and these conversations going on, how do you explain, or can you give us any insights into the Israeli relationship with the Russians I believe Netanyahu recently visited Putin in Moscow, and yet the Russians clearly are backing and supporting the Iranians who support Hezbollah, who's, you know, you get it. So what's the relationship, is it evolving and changing between Putin and Netanyahu and all these conversations, and what influence does Russia really have in terms of Israel's interests? That's a complicated question.
Yeah, it's very complicated. And I would start with the fact that I think that the main thing that you can see from this complicated situation with all those actors and interests that you see in the Middle East, the main thing is that we have an opportunity to see how Israel is important in the Middle East and for the world as interest, not as I'm not talking about values, and I'm not talking about a common common perspective, and I'm not talking about our character. I'm talking about the fact that Israel is actually the front line of the West in the Middle East. And one can criticize Israel for many things, and I'm sure that you will speak about Palestinians and other criticisms that you can hear here and there, but you cannot ignore the fact that the only moderate and liberal country is the only country that actually has a strong stability and a strong democratic culture and a strong liberal values. And for that reason, I think that the interest that we may check or understand or analyze usually are about how to maintain the advantage of Israel as democratic and liberal country in the Middle East. Those interests are not always clear. In one hand, you can talk with the Russians because they have become an actor in the area in the last 5 years. They decided that they want to be actor. It's not Israel didn't ask them. For sure, it wasn't an Israeli interest to see the Russians coming back to the Middle East, but they are there, and there is nothing to do if we want to send our airplanes to find weapons in Syria, Hezbollah weapons that suppose one day will use against Israel. We need to cooperate with the Russians and to have deep understandings. And the Iranians have connections with Russia. And of course, our greatest ally, which is the U.S. and Egypt and Jordan, which we have a very strong connections because we have a common interest regarding the Jordan Valley, which is, by the way, the worst nightmare of the Jordanians is to find the Palestinian state in the Jordan Valley. And we have a common interest because they are afraid from destability in their own country, because the main population in Jordan, or the main power in Jordan, I would say, is the Palestinians that from time to time find themselves in the clashes against the Hashemic regime. So all those interests together, it's a hard job to play with those interests in all of that in order to maintain the character of Israel and to maintain and to promote the advantages of Israel as a power, as an isolated power formally, but as a very connected power under the waves.
So one of the things that you just said was that, and it's interesting to me, because when you think about how complicated it is and how the game is played, the Israeli Air Force has made multiple strikes inside Syria against weapons that were headed for Lebanon that were supplied by the Iranians. And probably there's some conversation where you're flying in there, and with the Russians there, there's either notification prior or after, or an agreement that Israel can do this. And yet, how do you think the Russians explain that to the Iranians?
It's also an interesting challenge to the Russians, but I don't think that the Israelis or the Air Force asking permission from the Russians to attack weapons, the trucks or whatever in Syria or in Lebanon. I think that we have a kind of cooperations regarding the fact that from time to time we cross the airlines. And we have those understandings also with Turkey, even those that we have we had a conflict with Turkey until a few months ago. And the game is more complicated than it looks like. And I think that the U.S. has also an interesting role in the Middle East, specifically in Syria. And since the U.S. is also under a deep criticism in the Middle East from different actors and with a conflict with Russia. I don't know if it's going to continue with the new president, but until today with a different interest in the area, they also have an ability and limitations regarding what they can do in the Middle East. And we are playing in a very hard neighborhood. I have been in Australia 2 years ago, and it was my first time to find out that in the past there was a Zionistic plan to establish a Jewish state in Australia with a piece of a beach, a nice beach, and very important natural sources. So probably if we would live there, our only problem would be the Aborigines, and they are quite interesting and nice people. So we live in the Middle East. It's much more complicated, and unfortunately all the eyes focusing on the Middle East and all the armies, exactly like in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Age, all the armies are there and all the interests are there, and we need to play with those cards.
Do you think with the Russians' influence sort of resurgent, would be fair to say, in the Middle East, with their involvement in Syria, are they, from an Israeli perspective, and their influence or relationship with Iran, obviously, do they have more, or do you think, what is their role now in terms of influencing Hezbollah through their proxies? And are they, is it a good thing for Israel or a bad thing?
Look, in 2006, in the Second Lebanon War, which I participate as an officer in the reserve duty forces, we deeply understood that actually Hezbollah is one of the proxies of Iran, and they are sponsored by Iran. And by the way, after this war, which the Iranians actually find about it a few weeks after they started the war, or a few days after they started the war, they cut a big amount of the budget in those days. And today you can see it how actually Hezbollah involved in a war that they have nothing to do with, the internal war in Russia. And the fact that Iran still controlling Hezbollah after a lot of damage to the organization, after a lot of casualties to the organization, after they actually lost plenty of them soldiers, facilities, and other capabilities, I think one can understand that there is no independent Hezbollah today. There is an organization that practice based and motivate by Iran, which, as I mentioned, which is a world power or a regime power, and has different tools. One of them is the Hezbollah.
Okay. I just want to remind our listening audience, the program we're listening to today is How to Make Sense of the Disorder in the Middle East. Our speaker is Dr. Yoaz Hendel, and I'm Robert Rosenthal, the Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting. Is there, you know, let's change the subject a little bit. You're involved in, and I guess support human rights for the Palestinians. Is that fair to say? I mean,
I need to give a more description about what I'm doing because it's much more complicated. When I was director of communications, public diplomacy, I found out that Israel has become, I would say, the biggest tourism site in the world. You know for what? For human rights. Suddenly we found out that there are many activists that coming to Israel. Why specifically for Israel? Because they cannot go to other places. The Chinese are not really welcoming human rights activists. Russia, Putin is not really favorite with all those issues. Erdogan also. And even here, if you want to go to Guantanamo to criticize what's happening there, you cannot do that freely. So Israel, it's a very, I would say, interesting place to study and to understand human rights, even if you come into Israel in order to criticize the government. From my point of view, as director of communications and public diplomacy, the main conclusion that I had is, first of all, that we actually lost our ability to explain the balances in Israel. Why? Because I grew up in a right-wing camp in Israel. I grew up in a small settlement, which is which demonizing by the international community from time to time. It's like the obstacle for peace. And I grew up on the heritage of the founders of Zionism that spoke about our need to create a national state for the Jewish people and at the same time a liberal one. On the ideas that we are going, Jabotinsky is actually was the one of the founders of Zionism, and he is the symbol of the Likud party of Prime Minister Netanyahu, which spoke about his ideas that one day we will have a country with a Jewish prime minister and an Arabic vice prime minister, and they will replace each other every 4 years. And he said that everyone is a king. It's his famous sentence, not every Jew, everyone, Jew, Muslim, or Christian. And I grew up on these ideas and heritage. And suddenly, when I served in the prime minister office, I understood two things. First of all, that it's very hard to explain our policy, since our policy is not really straightforward. And every minister in Israel says something else. A Jewish state and every Jew has three opinions, so you can hear many opinions, and it's very hard to explain our policy. Secondly, that actually someone kidnapped my identity as liberal, as a national Jew. I know that national in English, it sounds very bad. So I will use the word, in Hebrew we use it because it means a patriot. So as a patriotic Israeli, and at the same time as liberal one. And I felt that someone kidnapped my identity as liberal. Those human rights organizations that came to Israel, and I more than welcomed them to come because we are a democratic country, they saw the picture in black and white. And they had no ability to see the complexity of the situation inside Israel. For example, checkpoints. We have checkpoints between If a Palestinian wants to get into Jerusalem, he has a checkpoint, he needs to cross a checkpoint. I found that those organizations see the checkpoint as an awful thing, and I even heard descriptions like I read once a human rights activist that called it Auschwitz. And I went there. I went to see how he described this. And I know those checkpoints. I know them quite good. And you see a place with soldiers and Palestinians, which is not that easy. It's much better to walk freely from the area of the Palestinian Authority to Israel. But you see a kind of a balanced place, a place that actually is a symbol of balance between our security needs and our liberal values. And when you understand that even if tomorrow morning there is a Palestinian state based on 67 borders, they will not be able to survive without walking in Israel, you understand that those checkpoints or border checkpoints or whatever, you can call it as you want, will exist even if there is an utopic solution. And when I understood that, I decided that I, first of all, I need to change my own way of thinking and how I look on things in order to maybe first of all to make Israelis understand what is what our challenge is, and then to bring other groups to understand the efforts that we're doing, not 100% success, but at least a lot of effort to maintain our character as a democratic and liberal country. Now, what I've done is actually I gathered a few volunteers. I sent them to a checkpoint. I took ex-Navy SEAL soldiers in order to educate the young kids on high schools about our liberal values and our ethical code at the IDF. We took a few doctors that gave Palestinians a medical treatment, and all of that in order to say, look, this is Zionism is about. We have, we see ourselves as Israelis, we see ourselves as part of the people that lives in this land, we see ourselves as Israelis, and our duties is to make sure that the people that lives in Israel and in the land of Israel, in other parts that we're responsible on, will gain the duties that they deserve. And the main goal is actually to create some balances for us, first of all, because we are not changing the world, and secondly, for people that would like to understand Israel in a better way.
One of the things you just said, you framed a lot of your perspective on the need, an essential need for Israelis to have security, and the state to have security, which I think everybody can understand. At the same time, do you understand what the anger, the humiliation of the Palestinians, or what they feel, in a sense, and what they have to, how do you balance that as a man or a human being? And do you ever feel empathy for them? And you've been in combat, and you understand what I'm asking, but the dynamic is really almost not a moral question, not an ethical question. It's just that balancing act and how that affects you as a human being.
Yeah, I understand, and I feel I understand completely that we're all human beings. This is how I educated, and this is how I educate my kids. I have four kids, and I think that what is interesting in Judaism and also in the ideas of Zionism from day one is the fact that we understand that there are more people in Israel, on the land of Israel, than only us, and we understand that we need to share and to respect other cultures and religions. It doesn't change the fact that, as I see it, I think that postmodernism is one of the sins of the Western world, and I'm not going to cross the line to what happened here with the last campaign, presidential campaign, and why Trump was elected. But as I see it, in national feelings and a patriotic feeling is a very healthy. It's a very healthy process in order to create a society. And I think that without patriotism, without identified you with your own people, it will be very hard to convince kids when they are getting to 18 in Israel to join the army. It's very hard to convince people when they are in their 40s to go to fight in the wars when they have kids in order to protect the country. And I'm saying that because I think that part of the Zionism is the word, very subjective word, but is justice, to justify yourself, to feel that what you are doing is the right thing. And I think that if we are looking on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I cannot be balanced. I cannot sit here and talk about both narratives. I know that it's very common in the academia. You speak about the narrative of the Palestinians and you speak about the narrative of the Israelis. I'm very Israeli. I'm 100% Zionistic. I'm very 100% in my side. I'm completely subjective. And what I see, it's a long conflict, 100 years, more than 100 years, between two people. Actually, Zionism is the only national movement that created two people, the Jewish people and the Palestinians, which until 67 and more than that called themselves Arabs. And what we see today, it's still a kind of a national conflict. It's still a kind of a religious conflict. And after I said all that, I think that Israel is the best place to live for Jews, for Muslims, and for Christians in the Middle East. And there is no doubt that if you take an Egyptian or a Saudi Arabia citizen or a Palestinian, and you compare his conditions and his ability and the limitations and capabilities, he would choose Israel. And we see it, by the way, with a lot of polls that we're doing in East Jerusalem on Palestinians that we actually gave them citizenship in 67. And we asked them, where do you want to live? In a Palestinian state one day or in a Jewish state? As you see today, and most of them prefer to see themselves as Israeli citizens, even though that they will not be part in a theoretical Palestinian state. I think that one of the things in order to maintain a democratic and liberal state country in an area like us is to wake up in the morning, to look at the mirror, and to feel good with yourself. Morality. I'm not talking about your own personal views, about your country as a national state, as a liberal state. We are not perfect. We have plenty of mistakes, and I'm sure that you have many questions about different headlines that you saw in the past and about soldiers here and there and plenty of mistakes that we have done. But I think that we're doing a lot of effort to maintain our character under a lot of pressure and under military campaigns and the threats every 2-3 years. And it's not easy, and I'm quite of proud of what we achieve. And I hope that we'll be able to continue with this road.
It's probably very fair to say you were not a fan of President Obama's foreign policy. But if you were still in this, I'll go back. We started the conversation talking about President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu meeting. If you were in the bubble, I so to speak, with the Israeli delegation now, what would you hope President Trump takes away from this in terms of maybe getting some wisdom, not only, and I mean this seriously, in terms of imparting something, not only from an Israeli perspective, but what he needs to understand about being the leader of the United States and foreign policy?
First of all, I appreciate President Obama. I think that he has a unique character in the history of America and a unique character in the history of the world. And I have a lot of criticism regarding his foreign policy, and I think that he did plenty of mistakes, specifically regarding Israel, but he was a supporter of Israel in many other aspects, and I appreciate what he has done. And I'm not saying it diplomatically. I'm not a diplomat. I can say whatever I want. I just think that there is a half empty glass and the full glass, and I know that we in Israel we have a lot of criticism regarding Obama, but I saw and I understand what he has done in his two cadences. I remember when I met President Obama and Hillary Clinton with Prime Minister Netanyahu at 2011, and I remember the bad feelings between both sides. We got into the room, and both advisors from both sides tried to tell without saying, without using words, to both leaders to smile. We did something like that to Prime Minister Netanyahu, and they did something like that to President Obama. And I remember it because I think it's a lot about spirit and atmosphere. And I think that without knowing how this meeting is going to end, first of all, a positive atmosphere exists. I think that what we see today it's not the issue. The problem or the challenge will be in a year, maybe in half a year, when President Trump will wake up and will understand his responsibility, and suddenly will hear the Saudi Arabia leaders and others that will ask him a few things, and he will understand his limitations. I think that we need, as I said before, I think that we are, as Israelis, we are in a pragmatic period. I think that we need to ask for pragmatic steps. Otherwise, Trump will be without anything to put on the table. He has so many challenges in here and in other parts of the world. I don't think that he's going to put Israel in his priority. And if he's not putting us there, he will be under a lot of pressure without a deep understanding of our situation. And for that reason, I encourage Prime Minister Netanyahu in my columns, and I see that other people encourage him to put something on the table. Unfortunately, domestic policy sometimes in Israel, as Henry Kissinger said, more important than foreign policy in Israel, and I hope that Netanyahu will find a balance for at least for this meeting.
Unfortunately, we have time for only one last question, and for many people, it's hard to be optimistic, but I think some of the things you said about ethics and values and morality can ring true with anything, and you said earlier you can't really predict the Middle East, but if you had to, in terms of some of your role or scenario playing in your past lives, what do you see, what will Israel look like, or what will the region look like? You have any idea in 20 or 30 years? I mean, we think about your children. What are they going to be facing?
Look, we need to start with the current situation. Israel, economically, is in the best situation ever. Securitily, we are in the best situation ever. There are not really armies that threaten us. Iran, even with a nuclear weapon, will not be able to eliminate Israel. So we are not in 67, we are not in 73. We are in a new, different area with strong Israel that flourish and has a lot of achievements. Today there is a huge high-tech conference, as I said, and many Israelis has come here because we are part of a very strong high-tech community. After I said all that, I think that our main problem are internal. I was a historian, a Jewish historian, and I remember the lessons from history about two states, two Jewish states that actually disappeared only because internal problems and internal conflicts. And my own conclusion is that in order to strengthen and to maintain the Zionist dream, the miracles that I see, to create a country in the desert and to make it strong economically and sociologically and even diplomatically, I think that we need to make sure that Israel society is strong enough. We have no constitution, unfortunately. We have a lot of gaps between different parts of Israel. We are still has a culture of tribes in Israel. We have a lot of challenges, internal challenges, and we need to cope with them. And I think that the Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Prime Ministers that will come after him will have to put a lot of attention and a lot of effort to make sure that in 20 years, as you ask, we are still the same Israel as we know today. And it's not easy even to maintain those achievements. It's not easy. I think that at the end of the day, the Zionist dream will be analyzed in 100 years and not after 70 years, and I hope that I will be around to see and to be proud again on what we achieved.
Okay. Our thanks to Dr. Yoaz Hendel for today's presentation. We also thank our audiences here and those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Robert Rosenthal, your moderator for today's program, How to Make Sense of the Disorder in the Middle East. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating 112 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.